This is Edward Mazur, the chairman of the City Club of Chicago, and our speaker at today's meeting was the Illinois State Comptroller, Susana Mendoza. She happens to be the first Hispanic woman to win an election statewide, and she had also been the first Hispanic woman to be elected to an office in Chicago as the city clerk. The comptroller's office was established in 1975 because of a gentleman named Orville Hodge, who embezzled $22 million in 4 years. So the comptroller's office was set up as an independent elected official to ensure checks and balances. There have been some differences of opinion between Governor Rauner and Comptroller Mendoza, to put it mildly, and the session was a very, very feisty session in which basically she said that the governor is of this world but not in this world. And her administration will emphasize transparency, accountability, and results. And she said Governor Rauner should do the same. Why have we had a budget crisis for 2 years? Well, according to Comptroller Mendoza, it's because we're not following the Constitution. We learned that Article 8, Section 2A, says that the governor should submit a balanced budget to the legislature before we go to 2B, Article 2B. The legislature is responsible for appropriating funds. Comptroller Mendoza said, we're unable to get from step A to step B. And meanwhile, there's $700 million in late interest penalties that eventually will have to be paid at the staggering sum of 12% interest. Mendoza versus Rauner. It looks like this one could go several rounds, folks.
How are we doing today? Here, honey, let me give you that. So, good afternoon. It's so exciting to be here again. This is my third time now. I'm starting to collect, like, the mugs, right? I think you get a mug at the end or something like that, but whatever. But good afternoon. My name is Susana Mendoza. I'm the Illinois State Comptroller. I wanted to start off by acknowledging my husband, but Jay did a pretty good job of that. He did mention how smart I am for having married this amazing man, David Sostak. So, honey, stand up. Because usually people are, you know, giving me all the kudos, but they really should be giving them to you. He's been so amazingly supportive and understanding, and it's extra special when you consider the fact that this is what we now consider getting together for a date. So, sorry, honey, but thank you. I also want to thank my staff, both Chicago staff and Springfield staff, and I even saw some former staff from the city clerk's office. To all of you, thank you, but I have to say in particular to my Chicago and Springfield staff in the comptroller's office, thank you so much. Now, these folks really deserve a round of applause because they have been working so hard, so hard. They've been putting in insane hours, and they've been doing their best to make sure that our office is running smoothly and that the state is not falling, you know, derailing, basically, coming off the tracks. And, you know, I'm guessing that some of you, it's a full crowd, so I'm thinking maybe some of you bought your tickets because you thought you might see some fireworks or something today. I don't know, maybe you thought that I'd show up to criticize the governor, but, you know, I have no intention of doing that. As a matter of fact, I'd like to actually give him some credit for some of the positive things that he's accomplished over his last 2 years in office. So I did ask my staff to put together a thorough list of his accomplishments over the last few years, so I can read them to you here today. So, all right, let's see. This page intentionally left blank. What's up, guys? I mean, well, it looks like my staff might need just a little bit more time for that. But, like, in all seriousness, I'm here today to talk about what the budget crisis is costing us as a state and as taxpayers, both in the short term and the long term. I used to say that the Illinois Comptroller's Office was the most important office that most people had never heard of. And I've only been in office since December, and I can safely say that I think that's starting to change. The Office of the Comptroller, for those of you who may not know, was created in 1970 by the Illinois Constitution. And it was done so because of a gentleman, primarily because of a gentleman by the name of Orville Hodge. Now, Orville Hodge was the Auditor of Public Accounts. I hear some laughing here, so I think some folks know about Orville Hodge. But, yeah, Orville Hodge was the Auditor of Public Accounts. That's the predecessor to the Illinois Comptroller's Office. And He only served one term, but during his four short years, he managed to embezzle over $6 million of taxpayer dollars, right? So probably not the kind of elected official we wanted in those days, but back in those days, the Auditor of Public Accounts did three functions, the auditing functions, the controller functions, as well as the treasurer functions. But as a result of, you know, clearly a very lack of oversight or no accountability, the Illinois Constitution in 1970 created the Office of Controller to serve as a check and balance on the executive branch. So unless anyone in this room thinks that Illinois is completely free of corruption or that an Orville Hodge could not happen again, I would say that it's probably a good idea to have an independently elected officer who can serve as a check and balance. Now, our state's current financial crisis has fundamentally changed the office of the Illinois Comptroller. Never in its 44-year history has our office had such a prominent role in state government. I think you may know the reasons, but in our office, we measure those reasons in the tens of billions of dollars. The state of Illinois is in the midst of the worst fiscal crisis in its history. There were warnings, but now we're seeing the results of fiscal mismanagement. You've heard about our bill backlog. Just last week, we hit a milestone. The state now owes an unprecedented $12.8 billion with a B. And that number's growing. We owe that to vendors, healthcare providers, service agencies, and educational institutions. Illinois has a population of 12.8 million people, so for some reference, that's $1,000 of unpaid bills for every man, woman, and child in this state. There's tens of thousands of vouchers that are waiting to be paid, and unfortunately, what we see on the horizon is much, much worse. And the Office of the Comptroller is square in the middle of it. It's our office that's at the nexus of this situation as we try to manage the state's finances. So what's my approach? Internally, what we're doing is we're taking a deep look at established practices. A month before the election, my predecessor, at the direction of the governor, paid out over $4 million of taxpayer money for employee bonuses. Right in the heat of an election. This, as social service agencies were closing their doors and laying off staff. I promised to change that irresponsible behavior, and I said I'd do it on my first day, and guess what? You know, I kept my promise. On my very first day, I decided and I made an order to all of the state agencies to give me vouchers differentiating between base pay and bonus pay, which my predecessor said could not be done. We did it on day one, and we moved those employee bonuses to the back of the line. I've also put the salaries of elected officials, including my own, at the back of the line. Externally, what we're doing can best be described as performing triage. We're being asked to make life and death decisions on a daily basis with very, very extremely limited resources. Now, my office has a very clear agenda, and that's this. We're putting the very neediest in Illinois first by prioritizing nursing homes and hospice care, ambulatory care, and medical care. But let me share a story with you as to how I was welcomed into my office on the day I was sworn in. On that very day, that first day, I received an email. This email came in from a woman who's on state health insurance. She's on the state health insurance plan. Now, it was a poignant and heartbreaking email. I'm going to call her Mary. Now, Mary was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy at the age of 4. And ever since then, she's needed constant care. The state, at that point, when she reached out to me, was over 6 months late in paying her health care bills. So as a result, her health care company or her insurance company had said that they were going to cut off her medical services on December 22nd. Think about that. Just a few days before Christmas. Now, Mary's parents can't take care of her anymore. They're both in their 80s, mid to late 80s, and they're both very sick. Her mother is battling terminal breast cancer, and her father can't take care of himself anymore and actually needs help himself. So Mary 100% depends on her state insurance to live. Now, cutting her off is a death sentence. It's that simple. She's wheelchair bound and she relies on a ventilator to breathe. So this story in and of itself is like, it's tragic. We hear stuff like this every day. But what really caught my attention on that first day was how Mary communicated that story to me. She did it in an email, but through a head mouse. Okay, a head mouse. It's a reflective sticker that she had in the middle of her forehead that allowed her to utilize her head movements in such a way where she could put words into text on a computer. Her story, it weighs heavy on me every day, and my staff always tells me not to tell it because I get choked up. Every day, I think about her. In the morning and at night. But you know what really eats at me about this story? It's all the other people that are even worse off than Mary, who can't communicate, whose voices are not being heard. And so, you know, Mary, she asked me to be an advocate for her. And I said, yes, but not just for her, but for everybody who's like a Mary in the state of Illinois. And that is why I do this. That is why I show up to work every day, ready to fight. That's what I have to do to make Mary's voice heard. It's why I've decided to take on this responsibility during this most challenging time in our state's history, because now, more than ever, the people of the state of Illinois deserve a controller who leads with a strong moral compass. Thank you to my staff for being there for me with this ride. Thank you. I'm fine, honey. Thanks. I got it under control. Thank you. This job, seriously, is the most intense, high-stress job I've ever had. And anyone who knows me knows that I work best under pressure. But so does my staff. And I'm leading an amazing group of people, and we are absolutely 100% ready for this challenge. Now, look, there is seriously not a dull moment in my office. We're in the midst of a court battle to ensure that frontline state employees continue to get paid in full and on time. Now, 2 weeks ago, we just won a ruling in court to pay state maintenance workers from funds that had positive balances of $93 million. So follow me on this, okay? Positive balances, we wanted to pay them out of that fund, $93 million positive, instead of adding to the general revenue debt fund, I should say the general revenue fund, but it might as well be the debt fund, which has almost $13 billion in the red, right? This is just common sense. You pay out of the fund that has money in it. But the governor, who's publicly stated his desire to force a government shutdown, dating back to March of 2013, he's the one who said he wants a government shutdown. He's been trying to stash money in separate accounts, special funds, so that he can weather a government shutdown. Now, he slipped up and he tipped his hand because his agency directors sent us some letters, and they referred to the State Garage Revolving Fund and the Facilities Maintenance Revolving Fund as the, quote, government shutdown prevention funds. All right? That's right. So, I mean, what do you think he has in mind with that? So, look, my office told him that, no, you can't continue to pay state garage and maintenance workers out of the general revenue fund, which is so far deep in the red. Instead, we're going to pay those employees out of, you know, the revolving funds that they're supposed to be paid out of. Those are the garage and maintenance funds that have positive funds of $93 million in them. You know, by the way, here's an important point. Those are the very same funds that his handpicked controller, my predecessor, paid those very same employees with over the last 2 years. He had no problem when she did it, but now it's a problem. So look, when I refused to add additional debt to the bill backlog so that he could continue to cash stash for his special funds for a government shutdown, he took me to court. But the good news is that he lost. And that was a huge victory from the courts, recognizing the independence and the authority of the Office of Illinois Comptroller. Well, thanks. Now, first, the governor said that he would honor the ruling. Then, within minutes, he said that the judge was part of the problem. And then he decided to take me back to court on appeal. Now, I'd just say to the governor that if he wants to keep wasting taxpayer money on frivolous lawsuits, that maybe he should pay for the court costs out of his own money and stop asking taxpayers to foot the bill. Now, as we've had a chance to open the books and see what's happened over the last 2 years, we've found some pretty jaw-dropping spending. You may have read just recently an AP story about the governor hiring a new deputy governor whose $138,000 salary he proposed to pay out of employee health insurance premiums. All right, imagine that. While insured state employees are being denied medical coverage, these are employees who have paid fully into their premiums, yet they're being turned away by doctors because the state is so late in paying its bills. While doctors and hospitals around the entire state of Illinois are waiting 6 months to a year, if not more, to get paid, the governor thought it was a good idea to have them wait, you know, just a little bit longer so that he could divert their money to a salary for a patronage hire. Do you know what else we found out? Now, you're hearing this for the first time, so this is a City Club exclusive. Are you familiar with the Healthcare Provider Relief Fund? All right, listen to the name of that. The Healthcare Provider Relief Fund. It receives federal medical reimbursements and is supposed to be used for, as its name suggests, paying healthcare providers. What we found is that over the past 2 years, the governor has paid out $112 million from that fund, not for doctors or medical services, but for consulting and management fees and contracts for computer software. A single consulting firm has received $27.6 million in consulting fees from the Healthcare Provider Relief Fund between January 2015 and March of 2017. Now, I'm just curious, do we have any healthcare providers in the room waiting 6 months or more for payment from the state? And I'm just curious how hearing this story for the first time makes you feel. The state's Medicaid backlog now sits at approximately $3.5 billion, again with a B. And because there's no budget authorizing me to pay those bills, taxpayers are on the hook for an additional $2 million a month in late payment interest penalties alone. Now, I think that's sick. Pun intended. Now, you probably heard also that last week I froze $27 million in spending for one of the governor's pet projects. That's his $250 million struggling enterprise resource program, known as the ERP. Now, what tipped us off to something fishy going on was that days before I took office, my predecessor transferred $71 million from the General Revenue Fund. Again, this is the fund that's sitting almost $13 billion in the red, into funds used to pay, in part, the ERP. Now, remember, this is happening against a backdrop of social service agencies having to lay off staff or close their doors because the state's not paying their bills on time. Now, you can tell their priorities by what they rushed through just days before leaving office. Years into this program, though, they haven't been able to offer us any documentation of how much money, any documentation of how much money they expect the state to save with this program, what all these consultants are actually doing for all of these millions of dollars, or why it's taking so much longer than originally projected. We've asked them to answer some of these questions, and we're still waiting. They have failed to answer a single one of our questions so far. Now, no one in this room or in the city of Chicago can question my commitment to modernizing technology, modernizing government through technology. Under my leadership, you might recall that I modernized the office of the city clerk. I brought it out of the Stone Ages. Right here in Chicago, we shifted more than 1.3 million Chicago City vehicle sticker users away from a system that was archaic with hours-long lines where we sold stickers on in 1 month of the year onto a streamlined, completely efficient, year-round sales system that has generated millions and millions of dollars in new revenue for the City of Chicago without costing taxpayers more and actually completely eliminated the hours-long lines that used to exist at City Hall. Now, I know a thing or two about innovation in government. Our office has been nationally recognized in that area, even having won the 2015 Bright Star Award from Harvard University. So I think my credentials there speak for themselves. But you know what is true is that I did not get a blank check from the city council for my technology upgrades. I needed to provide transparency, accountability, and results. And so should the governor. The days of the controllers... The days of the controller's office handing out blank checks for the governor's pet projects are over. I will be the check and balance that the Constitution intended this office to be. Now, if I have to choose between millions of dollars in this type of a fiscal crisis, millions of dollars going to outside consultants who haven't proven their worth yet, or choose between helping Mary's health care, I choose Mary. And I feel a responsibility to travel the state to meet the victims of our budget disaster. I got a letter recently from a Southern Illinois University professor who told me that she had been denied medical care after going to see a specialist for a rare blood disorder in St. Louis, and he told her, "I can't see you. You're on the Illinois Health Insurance Plan, and we are no longer taking any patients from Illinois on that plan." That's because, of course, the state is delayed 6 months to a year in paying any other bills. Now, clearly, this is outrageous, especially when you consider the fact that the university professor and every other state employee in Illinois has been paying fully into their premiums, yet are being denied medical coverage. Now, I told this professor that I wanted to actually meet her, and I planned a trip to go down to Carbondale, and I wanted to hear her story, but she also put together a meeting with over a dozen professors who shared similar horror stories about being denied medical coverage. Really scary things, like being denied cancer treatments or having their children no longer able to receive really critical mental health treatments. Is this really the type of state that we want to be? In Springfield, Illinois. It's not that far from here, folks. I drive there every week. Let me just say, right in Springfield, we now have state employees who have to pay for half of their surgical costs up front in cash, or else their surgery will not be done. I've been to Peoria to hear from a nursing home operator who was worried he might have to close down his facility, leaving 7,000 seniors unprotected. I met with parents at a child care center on the south side of Chicago who told me how crucial it is for them to have this program so that they can stay employed, contribute to the tax base, and actually see their children develop in a healthy way. Not to mention how important having a viable business is to the woman who owns it and the people who work for her. I know it's kind of depressing, but I'm going to share some good news. So stay with me here. Let's talk about the Well Center in Jacksonville in central Illinois. Now, they do some great work throughout the region, and they help people get off of substance abuse like drugs and alcohol. And they've been doing this good work, great work, I would say, in Jacksonville, Illinois, for the last 49 years. So how are they thinking about celebrating their 50th? You know, after spending all of this effort trying to save Illinois money by making sure that they can treat people at a lower cost and avoid them having to be treated in an ER or end up in an incarceration situation where it costs us so much more, they were going to celebrate their 50th anniversary by shutting down. Why? Because like all the great social service providers of Illinois, the state has been abusing over the last 2 years the Well Center, reducing support, cutting off payments, delaying payments. And 2 weeks ago, the center's board voted to close their doors. Now, we've been working really closely with the center as we work with all social service agencies. We're playing George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. Okay? When you know that part where he goes, "We can't give you all the money in your account, but what can you get by on?" Right? You remember that? That's us every day. We're just trying to keep Governor Rauner from turning Illinois into Pottersville. What can you get by on? What can you get by on? That is the story of our life every day. And it's wrong. So the governor's office constantly shops bogus stories against us to the press. I mean, Greg Hines just got one, and it's bogus. Apologies to the members of the press if they haven't wasted your time with bogus stories yet. I'm sure they will. So they shopped a story that the Wells Center was closing and somehow blamed me for that. I mean, I've been in office 3 months. But call Wells Center, and if you did, and all the calls that did go to Wells Centers confirmed the truth, that the center appreciated our working closely with them to try to solve this crisis. So I drove to the Wells Center with a few staff members last week and asked, what more could we do to help them try to survive? And here's the good news. Based on my visit, the board just voted to stay open. And it's great. It's great news. Now, it probably won't be forever. They're going to stay open, hopefully, for at least a few more months. And in the process, we're working closely with them to hopefully find a successor agency who can keep the services going. But the sad truth is that unless we get a budget soon, there will be more Wells Centers. And I won't be able to save them all. And there's going to be more Marys. And I won't be able to save them all. And that weighs on me every single day. And it should weigh on everybody in this room. And outside. People often ask me, why is the budget crisis even dragging on this long? I mean, it's been 2 years. What I tell them is that a basic lesson in civics is being ignored. So the Illinois Constitution, in Article 8, Section 2A, it's very clear. It says that the governor shall prepare and submit to the General Assembly a balanced budget proposal. Now, the governor hasn't done that. We're going on year three without him fulfilling his most basic constitutional duty per Article 8, Section 2A. Now, look, David and I know Jay mentioned that we have a little boy. His name is David Quinton, and he's super cute. Of course, I would say that, but he is really super cute. All kidding aside, yeah. Looks just like his dad. Yeah, but he's four, just turned four in December, and we're super proud of him because he speaks both languages, Spanish and English, and he knows his alphabet from A to Z in both languages. And it's a big deal. Now, yeah, round of applause for my little guy. He's the best, yeah. Let's lighten it up a little bit. But here's the deal. In both languages, in either languages, the alphabet starts with A. A comes before B. So let's apply this to the state budget. A, literally, Article 8, Section 2A, says that it's the governor whose job it is to propose a balanced budget. He hasn't done that. He's failed. Now, B, Article 2B, says that it's the legislature who's responsible for appropriating funds and then voting to pass a budget. After that, we get to C and D, and that could be like me as a controller paying the state's bills and the treasurer investing the state's money. But when we can't even get from A to B, much less C and D, that affects you. That's what's going on. So once A is out of the way, and again, by A, I mean the governor actually doing his job, then believe me, I'm going to challenge the legislature to do their job of passing a budget too. But first things first. Now, it also bothers me that as I travel the state and, you know, I get to listen to people and their stories, which are very powerful. I then try to tell those stories to folks like yourself or many other people across the state. And then cynics will dismiss my pleas for a budget, for a solution to this budget as some sort of political posturing. Or even worse yet, that I take my orders from someone else or I can't think for myself. Now, in case you haven't noticed, I'm pretty self-directed. There's only one person in the world who tells me what to do, and it's my mother. She's 81. And not only that, she tells David what to do and everybody else. But my mother couldn't be prouder of me for unapologetically making the case that Illinois needs to take care of its neediest and its citizens. So if you're wondering what it is that, you know, propels me to get up every single morning and get in the arena and fight to fix what's broken in this state and call out who I think is responsible, it's these people who are suffering. You know, it's the professors, it's the well centers, it's the Marys of Illinois. That's who. Those are the stories that motivate me. And telling their stories reminds people that these numbers, 12.8 billion bill backlog, you know, it's not just a number on a spreadsheet. It tells a story about people. There are people behind these numbers. And literally, there are millions of people now in Illinois who are suffering because we have no budget. So we hear so much about social service agencies. I've just talked a bunch today about social service agencies closing. But I really fear that people are becoming desensitized to yet another closure. Oh, one more. This is bad, folks. You know, we need to find our humanity right here and right now. And we cannot let our hearts turn to steel and fall victim to the disease of indifference. Earlier this month, my office, we put out the comprehensive annual financial report. And, you know, it's just 300 plus pages for those of you who would like some light reading. It's a snapshot of our state's fiscal health, but more importantly, the bond rating agencies and folks in the field of finance look at it very carefully. Now, what the report shows is no surprise. The state's fiscal situation is abysmal. According to the report, our deficit passed $126 billion. Okay, $126 billion as of fiscal year 2016. And it's now actually surpassed $130 billion. The state has pension liabilities of $116 billion, and that number is growing. The report also shows that the state is spending less on its neediest residents. Spending on health and social service programs dropped by $834 million in fiscal year 2016. Let me repeat that. The state has disinvested in its neediest people by at least $834 million. If that's not shocking enough, please consider that at the very same time as our state disinvests in the neediest, its taxpayers are on the hook for at least $700 million in late payment interest penalties alone. Now, $700 million in late payment interest penalties. We're paying 12% interest for paying our bills late. I mean, that's $700 million that will never go towards spending a dollar on the needy. It will never go towards business growth programs. It will never be used for educational programs. It will never be used to create a single job in this state. It is a total loss. When we cut funds for the neediest, and then we're forced to pay off insane amounts of interest, that's a double whammy of fiscal and moral irresponsibility. Folks, our state is coming apart at the seams. The scenarios I'm describing, they're the symptoms of a failed state. And I think it's important that everyone should acknowledge that there's an actual cost to inaction, and it's expensive. One area where the governor and I do agree is that our state does need a capital plan. But every single day that we go without a budget, that capital plan becomes more expensive. Because we're going to still have to pay way more in interest just to finance it. Our state's bond rating currently stands just two notches above junk status. And part of that is the governor's fault. The bond rating agencies point to his failure to propose a balanced budget, and specifically his willingness to hold the budget hostage to pass unrelated pet projects like term limits or redistricting as the cause of Illinois' downward financial spiral. Let me read this word for word so there is no one can say that I put words in their mouth. Standard & Poor's wrote in its most recent critique, quote, "Illinois' fiscal crisis is, in our view, a man-made byproduct of policy ultimatums placed upon the state's budget process." That critique isn't coming from me as a Democrat. It's not a Republican viewpoint. This is S&P saying the governor's position is going to cost you, as a state, more. Before Governor Rauner, the bond rating agency said the state was moving in the right direction. Look, nobody says things were perfect, but they were moving in the right direction. The state was paying down its backlog of bills. For four consecutive years, the bill backlog was shrinking. Since Governor Runner took office, our bill backlog has more than doubled, and he's seen six credit downgradings since taking office. Funding for community care, and Greg, where are you? Greg Hines, he pitched his story about community care. Let's talk about community care, Greg. Community care, which keeps ailing seniors in their home, has plummeted under this governor. And what message does that send? Do people in Illinois care less about seniors today than we did 2 years ago? Are those seniors getting any younger? Does this actually save tax dollars? You know, the short answer is no. Keeping people in the dignity of their own home is not only the right moral thing to do, it's also fiscally sound. We've invested over, as soon as I took office, we invested over $110 million in community care because we prioritized them well beyond what the prior administration did. So, Greg, we're happy to provide you the stats. Now, here's more from the report. Funding for breast and cervical cancer screenings has been cut by two-thirds since fiscal year 2014. Now, are fewer women getting cancer? No. In 2014, our state invested $20 million in youth job programs. 2 years later, that number was zero. $20 million to zero. Violence in urban areas has peaked while the state cut funding for anti-violence programs such as Ceasefire. In fiscal year 2014, the state spent $3.5 million on Ceasefire, but then 2 years later cut it by 98%. You know, no wonder violence continues to grow in this city. These are budget cuts, but please don't mistake them for reduced spending because they're costing us a lot more. To me, being fiscally sound means receiving a good return on your investment. It means making sure that money's being spent wisely. You know, I've often found that when we do the morally correct thing, it's more often than not also the fiscally sound thing. To that point, I'd refer you to studies that show that for every $1 we invest in addiction treatment in places like Wells Center in Jacksonville, we save taxpayers $7 on juvenile state services and $14 on adult incarcerations. So whether you know it or not, you're paying for these troubled young people and their care. It's either in a setting like Jacksonville or it's in prison. Now I'll put it to you this way. Would you rather that the government take $1 out of your pocket when you're looking or $14 when you're not? The choices are simple. We can either help people identify health problems at a lower cost or pay more for their treatments after they're already sick. We can either provide job opportunities to young people or pay the much more expensive consequences of youth unemployment. We can provide alternatives to gang violence or manage the tragic fallout of an action. Making cuts to these types of programs, it's short-sighted and it's expensive, and it's also not in line with our better nature. Another smart investment is higher education. Our state's public institutions provide benefits that extend far beyond their campuses. For every $1 invested in higher ed, generates $4 in economic activity for the state. But in Illinois, support for higher education has been cut by 58% over the last 3 years. And like the business community, our higher education system needs stability and predictability. Our disinvestment in higher education is making high school graduates one of our state's biggest exports. We're losing, on average, a net 16,000 college-bound students each year to other states. And it's not just the students, we're also losing great professors. Now, this hurts our business community because businesses need a talented workforce. And I would argue that this is no way to build a talented workforce. The business community should honestly be up in arms about what's happening to higher education in the state of Illinois. Now, I don't tell the governor, do your job, because I'm trying to score points politically. I'm saying it because our state's going to continue to suffer until he does. Introducing a budget like the one he did in February, a budget that's $7 billion out of whack, I don't interpret that as a serious attempt at resolving the budget stalemate, and neither does any serious Democrat or Republican in this state. The governor has said he wants cuts, but when his agency directors went before the Senate Appropriations Committee just last week, they refused to provide a single suggestion for a cut. That's their job. Governor, you can't say all the time, you need to make tough cuts. But when you're asked where you'd cut, or your staff is asked where they'd cut, they refuse to provide a single one. And we have Senate Minority Leader Christine Rodogno. Here's a Republican senator who I've served with, who's been working very hard over the last few months to try to craft a bipartisan agreement, a compromise to end the budget impasse. But then her own governor hung her out to dry when he killed the Senate grand bargain. Now, it took guts to do what she did, and I give her a ton of credit for it. And for those of you who follow Rich Miller, as he would say, I would like to say more like this, please. Governor, you can't say over and over that you want to send a grand bargain and then kill the deal, right?
I'm almost done, Ed.
You only can feel it. Yeah. Okay. During my 10 years in the General Assembly, I truly prided myself as being one of the most bipartisan legislators to ever serve under the dome. As controller, I'm working with legislators from both parties to help prioritize payments to their most vulnerable constituents. I don't care if they're Democrats or Republicans. I just want to help. And I'm going to point to my dear friend Kirk Dillard here. I mean, you know that I speak truth to that because I had the pleasure and honor of serving with him for many years, and he's the same way. So, but here's the final thing. I can be one of the nicest people in the world. Nicest people you'll ever meet. I hope that's why lots of friends are in this room today. But I can also be one of the fiercest warriors when I'm fighting for something that I believe in. And I believe in the state of Illinois deeply. I've traveled to every corner of this state. I know the character of its people. And we're good neighbors. We're good people. We look out for each other. We care about seniors. We care about our young people. We want jobs. Our disinvestment in our human capital does not reflect the values of our state. Whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, it just doesn't. My parents came here from Mexico, and they left everything behind to come here to Illinois. Out of all 50 states, they picked this one because it is the best one. They believed in this state then, and I believe in it now. We need a budget. We need the stability and predictability that comes with a budget. We have a daunting task ahead of us, but it is a call to action, and no one can afford to give up. I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet, and I promise you, this is a great state, and there are better days ahead of us. Thank you so much for entertaining my long speech, and I look forward to answering any questions that might arise. Let's get back to work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Susanna. Thank you, Comptroller. We have time for a few questions.
Okay.
Because I think you answered a number of the questions that have been submitted. But Charlie Gardner, trustee of Roosevelt University, how do you really feel about the Senate's grand bargain? Should it pass?
Well, what I think is that, again, how I really feel is that the governor should not have abdicated his responsibility of presenting a balanced budget proposal to the Senate. I'm glad that there are people who are adults in the room who are actually picking up his slack. You know, again, this goes back to, it doesn't matter how hard they're working, and I think Senator Rodogno is a perfect example of how hard she's actually working trying to find a solution. If that very solution is going to be undermined by the person who's supposed to be leading this budget. So, you know, I'm conflicted in the sense that I'd like to see a budget, and I was very disappointed to see that this wasn't even able to make it out of the chamber for consideration in the opposite budget.
This is from City Club member Elizabeth Austin. She brings to our attention that State Senator Joyce Holmberg of the Rockford area passed away last evening.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that.
And we want to just take a moment to...
A moment of silence.
Silence and thank her for her service. She goes on to say she was one of her lifelong role models. Who are your role models, and what impact do they have on your work as comptroller?
Sure. Well, you heard me speak about my greatest role model is my mother. And I think her impact is clearly visible off of my speech today. She wants me to keep fighting. She wants me to stand up to bullies. She wants me to take it to them on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. So for me to just have been elected to this office and then just be a wallflower, anybody can do that. I've never been that way. My whole entire career, I have run for office assuming that this is the only term I'm going to do. Why? Because, I don't know, I can get hit by a bus tomorrow. So while I'm there, I want to do the best that I possibly can. And that's the only thing my mother's ever asked me to do. She never even wanted me to get into politics. She said everybody was a viper. I'd be surrounded by them, and I was too nice to do this. And I said, Mom, you know, if you want politics to be better, you need good people running for office. So once I made the decision to do it, she was all in, and she's been supportive and just doesn't want me to back down. You know, another of my greatest, of course, my father, I could go forever. We only have a couple minutes. So my mom and dad are by far my greatest and most influential mentors of my life. And when it comes to politics, I'd say my next greatest mentor has been Secretary of State Jesse White. His story is a great story that should inspire anybody to aspire to public service. And there's been one politician my entire voting career that I have looked forward to going to vote for every time, and that's Secretary White.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. This morning's Tribune, by the way, if someone wants to see a picture of this, her son and David's son, David Quinton, page 8 in the Tribune. You're quoted as saying that the governor lives in a bizarro world. What do you mean by that?
I kind of feel like it's self-explanatory, and it's just kind of further proof that I speak truth to power.
Okay. Is the state of Illinois government in imminent danger of shutting down?
I would say we need a budget. I think that Governor Rauner, back in March of 2013, said that if he was given an opportunity to shut down government for a little while, that's what he'd do. So it's you know, going back to this bizarro world, what's bizarro is that he would continue to try to accuse everyone else under the sun of conspiring to shut down government when I have never said I want to shut down government. I want to help government. He, on the other hand, is the only elected official that I know in this state who is on the record having said that this was his plan all along. So we should have believed him in 2013. That was the real Bruce Rauner, not the Twitter version. And believe it now, because if we are headed towards a government shutdown, it is only as a result of the governor's inability or desire to actually not do his constitutional obligations of introducing a balanced budget proposal and working with the legislature in good faith, not doing things like killing the Senate grand bargain.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's give Comptroller Mendoza a round of applause.